All right, our third case for this morning is Morty against Ziegler, and whenever you're ready, Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the Illinois State Police defendants. We're asking the Court to reverse the denial of qualified immunity at summary judgment for five independent legal reasons. One is the ruling on qualified immunity itself, of course, because it's not clearly established even today what without delay means in the Article 36 of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. In addition, this Court could be the first to decide what without delay does mean. And it's certainly because any law that does exist states that it couldn't possibly mean either during an arrest, Trooper Ziegler, or during an initial interrogation. This Court also could reverse the denial of qualified immunity on the merits because it could find that there is no private right or private remedy, which would also allow this Court to end an unnecessary circuit split between Yogi 2, this Court's decision in Yogi 2, and every other circuit that's addressed the question of a private right or a private remedy. And last but not least, also this Court could address the question of whether the convention is self-executing.
Is this the first case that has come up on this issue since Yogi 2?
On the issue of
Article 36?
No, because every other court that has...
No. In this circuit, in Illinois.
I'm only asking
about Illinois.
I'm sorry. No,
I'm
there
sorry,
was,
I wasn't clear.
Sorry. There was one case shortly after Yogi 2, the Osagieda, I think it is, O-S-G-I-E-D-E, I believe.
Osagieda, yeah.
Right, but it was a habeas case, and it followed Yogi 2 because that was the circuit precedent.
Right. Yogi 2 said there's no right in habeas. There's no criminal law.
There's no remedy. It said there was a private right, but there was no remedy in habeas, right? Because
suppress,
no suppression of
habeas,
no right, yeah. Exactly, no dismissal of the right indictment.
So the reason I'm asking that is that I'm wondering where the flood of cases is that's causing the problem. Because if there is no flood of cases, then it would strike me that the more modest theories that you began with, whether without delay means at the stage that officers Ziegler or Chance or Healy was acting, or whether it really means at a minimum you've got up until booking, or whether it's clearly established. It seems like those are such straightforward ways to go. I don't know why, if it's not a big problem, we should do the other.
Well, again, Your Honor, as we pointed out, in Hill, this Court has said if the Court can re-examine in light of subsequent precedent, particularly in this case, Medellin 2, I suppose, and Garcia, in addition, the other three circuits, all of which have addressed this question and come down the other way, if the Court decides to re-examine it, it can then end the unnecessary circuit split. But as you suggest, it doesn't have to, because there are at least two more straightforward ways to allow reversal, which is both on the merits of the intent behind without delay, which the travaux préparatoires indicate could be anything between a day and a month, 2 days and a month, what we think is the easiest ground is to is the qualified immunity, because in fact there is no clearly established law that without delay would encompass an arrest and an initial interrogation. And in fact, the existing law from the Virginia Supreme Court, so on, and also the decision, a sort of footnote in Medellin 1, indicate that it couldn't possibly be during arrest or the initial interrogation.
Well, so the purpose of Article 36, if you like looking at the travaux préparatoires and the other things, is to ensure that through the process of a criminal investigation, the alien has the assistance of his or her own government. There could be source materials in that government, under that government's control. Most countries in the world, as you probably know, take a very dim view to discovery or its analog from the U.S. taking place within their own borders. So unless the alien has the assistance of his own government, that's going to be difficult, if not impossible. I can see that one might say from that standpoint, up until the time somebody's booked, there may not even be a problem. I mean, there are preliminary things, there are arrests, maybe there's a little bit of pre-booking interrogation, but not until booking do you know that the need for that kind of home country assistance is there. And of course, the shoe is on the other foot as well for treaties. The United States has at least as many of its nationals out and about in other countries as others are here, and we rely on this treaty to ensure that we can help our own citizens.
That's correct, Your Honor. But if I may, in fact, the purpose, the text, you know, the context of this treaty is for consular functions.
Right, and but so, we talked about that extensively in Yogi too. Most of the articles of the treaty are like that. It's just that when you see an article that talks about the individual's rights, you have to do some contortion to say that's not about the individual's rights.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, if you read the Travaux Perpetuels themselves as opposed to the...
They're five volumes long. They're like all legislative history.
And we waded through them, and you see, though, that the focus of them is the reason that the information right, if you will, as the plaintiff talks about it, the right to be informed, if that the way that that came about was that the drafters were trying to decide between either notifying a consulate every time someone was detained, or notifying them, or waiting. And so what they decided that they didn't want to, it was too burdensome to tell a consulate every single time someone was arrested.
But other speakers in those same travaux mm-hmm. said, we don't want to impose notification. Suppose that somebody's seeking right. asylum. They're here, they're from Somalia or someplace, and right. they really don't want somebody to pick up the phone and call the Somali consulate or embassy.
Right.
So that's why in subpart B of part one, they said, we're going to wait and just let the individual request, and only in that case. So, you know,
right. But Your Honor,
it's like a Rorschach test. I think...
In fact, though, Your Honor, what you're right in that the Travaux Perpetuels talked about the right to veto the notification,
and,
if you
and
will.
And it was but the individual's right to do that.
To veto,
and it
yes.
his right to the, and thus his right for the notification.
In fact,
that's why the language says, the said authority shall inform the person concerned without delay of his rights under this subparagraph.
But in fact, Your Honor, there is no prohibition in Article 36 against notifying the convention. It's a trigger, but it's not a prohibition. And in fact,
what do you get from that?
I'm sorry?
Assuming you're correct, what inference do you draw from the fact that you see no prohibition?
That in fact there's no duty on the part of the receiving state, the arresting state, to honor a request. And in fact, the United States State Department manual...
Right. That goes well beyond arguing that the convention is not self-executing. The convention plainly imposes a duty on the receiving state. The self-executing question is how that is carried out, whether it's carried out by the Secretary of State or whether it's carried out in litigation. But to say there's no duty is... Well, you don't need to make such an argument.
No, I was just responding to the court's question, Your Honor.
You don't need to respond to the court's question by stating the opposite of what the language of the convention says.
Your Honor, in fact, the United States Manual on Consular Notification says there is no prohibition, that the convention does not prohibit notifying if the detained person says that they don't want the consulate to be notified. But as the court indicates, that's really neither here nor there for this case. The easiest question, as the court has indicated earlier, is that there is no clearly established law in 2009 or even today that would allow every single official in these defendants' views shoes to know that this what to that they well, had to inform.
When you say no clearly established law,
yes, Your Honor.
Footnote 1 of the first Medellin case says that notice within 3 hours of arrest is not required.
Correct.
Dictum, obviously, but it, correct. It says that. Are you aware of any subsequent authority that goes into the timing question? I'm going to be asking this question of Mr. Koala as well.
As we mentioned in our brief, Your Honor, the only case that we really ran across was the Virginia Supreme Court case that said there was no Article 36 violation when the person who was identified as a foreign national before the end of the initial interrogation was not informed, and that in fact the informing and notification did not take place for 36 hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
There is the Illinois State Police policy. Doesn't that pose a problem for qualified immunity?
The policy, well, the manual is not law. Clearly, it can't clearly establish the law. I mean, not even a state law could do that, right? And so the manual says only promptly, and the United States manual says by or at booking. So really, there is, and that manual itself also would not clearly establish the law. So really, there is certainly no circuit precedent. There's no Supreme Court precedent except the dictum, as the court mentioned in Medellin 1 about the 3 hour, the initial interrogation. There simply is no clearly established law, and because of that, we again ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
All right. I'm just going to say, as you sit down, I am looking forward to the day when these manuals in the State Department take care of the United States' obligation as a sovereign nation to comply with Article 36. I mean, these lawsuits are a second best or third best or tenth best solution to that problem. Surely this manual is supposed to mean something to the Illinois police as a matter of practice, not as a matter of legal liability or anything else.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes. Mr. Koala.
May it please the court, Ryan Koala on behalf of Uche Philip Morty.
Mr. Koala, let me start you with the question I asked to Ms. Welch. Right, we know that footnote 1 in Medellin 1 says that lack of notice within 3 hours, no problem. Confession within 3 hours, no problem, because that was before there was any obligation to give notice. Your argument in this case depends on the proposition that it is clearly established that footnote 1 of the Supreme Court is wrong. Where was that clearly established?
I think it's clearly established in the text of the treaty itself.
When the Supreme Court wrote Medellin.
That's not going to cut it. The Supreme Court wrote long after that. And, of course, the Avena decision, the International Court of Justice, said notice within 36 hours was enough. So I want to know where it was clearly established that both Avena and footnote 1 in Medellin are wrong.
Well, I think what the Avena case was saying is that
I'm not asking you to interpret Avena. I'm asking you to tell me where, presumably some subsequent decision or treaty or statute, where it was clearly established that those two things are wrong.
Maybe in Medellin case, I'm not sure that it was clear that the arresting officers within those 3 hours were aware that...
If you can't cite an authority, you are not answering my question. For something to be clearly established, there has to be a place where it is clearly established. It could be clearly established in judicial decision. It could be clearly established in some statute or treaty. I am asking you to cite me the place where you believe this rule was clearly established. I'm not asking you to make an argument about why it should be established. I want you to tell me the place where it was clearly established.
I can't offer you a citation at this time, Your Honor, as to where footnote 1 of Medellin was cited and claimed as being wrong.
So here's the problem that you have, given that. You have Officer Ziegler who arrests and, as I understand, transports your client a couple of times. This is all happening within the space of one day. It's all from 1:30 in the afternoon on March 12, 2009 to 9 p.m. when he's finally booked by somebody else, not, as I understand it, not a defendant here. So the other two people here are Officers Chance and Healy, who interview him for a bit. Whether, you know, there are Miranda issues with that, I mean, I don't really care because that's not our issue. So he has sued the arrester and transporter and the interviewers, but he doesn't seem to have sued the people who booked him. And even if, as I think you said in your responsive brief, he never received notification of his Article 36 rights, you can't hold the somebody who wasn't responsible for doing this anyway responsible for it. I mean, so that's my issue. Even if never isn't promptly, I get that. Never isn't promptly, at least in my dictionary. But you've sued these three people who may not have been anywhere within the time or function zone that Article 36 contemplates. Or to put it more nicely, in a different way, that at least there's nothing that clearly establishes that Article 36 says the very first contact or in the very first interview or within 9 hours. I mean, it doesn't seem to say anything like that.
Right. What I would offer is that the appellants were informed during the interview process that Mr. Morty was born in Nigeria and not a U.S. citizen.
Right.
And they never at any point during the detention or any point subsequent make any effort to inform Mr. Morty of his rights under Article 36.
So why were these defendants, who really are just serving Mr. Morty up to whoever it was who did the booking, I guess it was in Effingham County, not everybody has every function, right? The state police assign different responsibilities to different officers, and I agree with you that there's clearly a breakdown in the system here. There's a manual that Judge Tinder referred to that the Illinois police have. Somebody should have told him, but we have a 1983 case brought against three particular people. And the question is, should they have to stand trial for possible money damages for not doing something when maybe nobody ever said they should have done it?
The reason is because Article 36 imposes the obligation on the receiving state authorities.
Well, but you see, that's very broad language, and the Supreme Court tells us in the qualified immunity area we need to be very specific about what exactly it is the person should have known. We don't want to place impossible burdens on our public officials at risk of damages. And the other thing Article 36 says is it leaves it up to each receiving state to figure out the best way to implement the rights that Article 36 outlines. You know, in civil law countries, I imagine it's done differently from the way it's done in common law countries and so on. That's fine. That's a very common thing for conventions to do. They don't micromanage national law or municipal laws, they would say. So yes, the convention says the state should do it, but does it mean Officer Ziegler? Does it mean anybody instantly?
Well, I think the question to ask under these circumstances with the appellants having the information that they had and having the Illinois State Police policy, the written policy that said that this information must be supplied promptly, and that was based on Article 36. In view of that, in view of those circumstances, I don't think that any reasonable officer could understand that to mean that there is no requirement to ever inform the detainee.
What if after the interview with Officers Chance and Healy, they had said, well, we thought there was a problem with Mr. Morty, but we're satisfied now that there really isn't. And they just let him go. He was never booked. Would there have been some duty anyway to have notified the consul, the Nigerian consul?
Under those circumstances, they let Mr. Morty go. In light of the Medellin decision, I suppose it would be in that particular situation. I guess it would not be clearly established, but that's not the situation that's before this court.
Well, I mean, but my point is that you could imagine a rational convention that would say there isn't a duty to go scurrying around and trying to figure out what's the nearest Nigerian consulate to Effingham, Illinois, until you know that there's really a process that's going to take place. And the first moment that you know that, somebody could think might be booking. Because I would imagine that sometimes people get arrested and there's a conversation and they are released. And so if you have a duty to just rush off and notify at the first instant, within 3 hours, which the Supreme Court said, that's really not required, there would be some sense to such a regime.
We're not even talking about, and my answer, with all due respect, we're not talking about the obligation even to inform the consular office. We're talking about the obligation to inform the person who's sitting across the table from the officer. There's nothing to prevent that. And there's no reason not to. I think they, in the Medellin case, they made clear that they were free to continue interviewing him and interrogating him. And if he said he wanted the help of the consular office, they could go ahead and contact the consular office. But they could continue to interrogate him. It's dissimilar to invoking a Fifth Amendment right. The inconvenience. There is no inconvenience of telling somebody who's sitting across the table from you that they have rights under an international treaty.
But that's an interesting position to take, because it suggests that the consequences of failure to notify, in your view, are practically nil. You tell the person, would you like it? We see you're a Nigerian citizen. Would you like us to notify the nearest Nigerian consulate? And he says yes, and they say, okay, we'll get around to it next week. And so they continue interrogating. It's just kind of a strange rule that that somehow the notification and the time period are that divorced, the time when it actually means something.
I think the wording would imposing the obligation without delays to allow the detained individual to exercise his right at the earliest possible moment.
Right. And under subparagraph 2, the receiving state then also has an obligation to act in a way, as they say, to enable full effect to be given to the purposes for which the rights accorded under this article are intended. So the receiving state, if the individual says, yes, please tell my consulate, has a duty under paragraph 2 to respond, to do something with the notification.
Correct.
And that must be the case.
There's an obligation.
That's why I'm tying the two time periods together. If 3 hours isn't required to notify the person, then you also have a little more time to notify the consulate.
I think that there's a difference between talking to somebody who's across the table and reaching a consular office that may be thousands of miles away. The point is that the obligation of without delay means that you set to the task as soon as is reasonably possible. You may not achieve the task. You may not achieve notification of the consular office with instantly. It may take 36 hours or 3 business days, but the obligation to inform the person sitting across the table once it arises, that should be discharged forthwith, promptly, as the manual says.
So I have one final question for you. I know you're running out of time. Wouldn't you think, if you're right, that the State Department would have taken this position, that would have spelled this out in its guidance?
Well, the State Department seems to be taking two separate positions. They seem to take one position in litigation in cases involving foreign detainees in the United States, and take quite another with respect to interests of Americans traveling abroad. There's frequent sites that when in reference to Americans traveling abroad, that the State Department has said that these individuals do have rights under the Vienna Convention. So I guess that's all I could say to that.
Okay, that's fine. Well, if that's what you have to say, apparently we have no more questions for you. Would you like to wrap up?
I would just close with the point that the Vienna Convention it has importance not just for detainees in this state, in the United States, but for Americans traveling abroad. And if we ignore those rights here at home, I don't think that we can reasonably expect those rights to be respected abroad.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kawala. Anything further, Ms. Welsh?
Briefly, Your Honor. In fact, to address something the court mentioned earlier, a plaintiff did in fact sue the booking officers and the county and so on, because we don't book anybody, they go to counties. This was Effingham County. And the district court found that they were entitled to qualified immunity. Plaintiff obviously couldn't appeal that, because that was an interlocutory ruling. But the court brings up a good point, and the State Department manual explains that booking really is probably the best time to do this, to give the information, because then you can find out and verify if the person is a citizen of another country, if in fact that other country is a signatory, because if the other person isn't a signatory, no arresting officer is going to know this. If the person is not a member of a citizen of a signatory agency, then the question doesn't even come up. And then also that would be the best time they could find on a computer, of course, where the closest consulate is, and they can notify the consulate if the person so requests, or if there are some, as I mentioned, there are some, maybe I didn't, there are bilateral treaties in addition to the Vienna Convention, that some of which call for notification regardless of what the person wants and the detainee wants, and some of them have a particular prohibition, that if the detainee says no, then it's no, that you don't notify. That's only for Ireland, to my knowledge. It seems that there is no clearly established law that from which any person in these defendant's shoes would know that Article 36 required them in particular to inform the plaintiff of the availability of consular notification. And because that wasn't established today or certainly not then, in 2009, then the district court made an error of law in finding that the defendants were not entitled to qualified immunity, or, in fact, that the defendants violated Article 36 in the first place, although, again, the court doesn't even need to reach that question.
So basically everybody else prevailed.
Correct.
From your standpoint in the district court, except for these three.
Correct.
Which is why
correct.
This is all that we have.
Yeah. Right. That's right, Your Honor. So unless there are any further questions, we ask the court to reverse and find that, at the very least, defendants are entitled to qualified immunity in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Kawala. We will take the case under advisement.